Hi everyone, welcome back to the Media Mates podcast. My name is Ralph Tucker. Each week I'll chat to somebody I've met from my career in and around the media industry. All of them have such great stories to tell. I'm not Michael Parkinson or Andrew Denton, but I do enjoy chatting to interesting media people about where they've been, where they're headed next, and everything else in between. My guest today is Natalie Peters from 2GB. Natalie has been working in Sydney media for over a decade as a newsreader with WSFM and 2GB. She chats about how working in the snow opened her eyes to the media world, learning her craft under the watchful eye of a Sydney radio icon, and hitchhiking her way to cover the Christchurch earthquake. Natalie is someone I've known for a long time, and I'm very proud of what she's achieved in her career to date. So I really hope you enjoy our chat. Natalie Peters, welcome to the Media Mates podcast.
Thanks, Ralphie. I'm a little nervous.
Now, we should set the scene. We're probably at one of my favourite old haunts, having worked at 2GB a number of years ago, the Harlequin Hotel, or the Harlequin Inn at Pyrmont. It's lost none of its charm.
Well, I think the carpet might have been replaced since those days, but I don't know. It's pretty smelly, but you know.
Now, let me get this right. 2GB breakfast newsreader for Alan Jones?
Yes.
Your deputy news director?
Yes.
You also host a show on Sunday night with Michael Packey?
I do.
A number of hats?
Yes, at the moment, yeah, very busy.
And comfortable with all of those?
Yeah, it's a juggling act, but I mean, they all play into each other, I think, and you know, there are so many people at 2GB that do work for a few different departments. You know, we've got Mark Levy, who's on air pretty much 24/7, but he's doing sport with the newsroom, or you know, hosting or calling football games. So everyone kind of does a little bit, and that's pretty cool to get those opportunities. Yeah.
And how long have you been there for now?
It's almost 6 years since I came over from WS.
Wow.
Yeah, 6 years in October, so time flies.
And it's certainly gone quickly for you, you think?
Yeah, for sure. Gosh, it doesn't feel like that long ago that I was at WS. Every now and then I still say we, as in talking about what we did in the WSFM newsroom. So yeah, it doesn't feel like that long ago at all.
Let's go backwards and work it out and sort out a timeline for you. Was media something that was always something that you wanted to pursue, or was it, did you have a different career path pegged for yourself?
Well, I had many career paths pegged for myself, I guess. I kind of, through high school, saw all sorts of things that interested me, and at one stage I wanted to be a cop. What else was there? You know, I wanted to be a ski bum, which I did for a few years early on. But yeah, once I got to year 12, I thought, right, I really like the idea of the communications degree. I had a few friends that were signing up for it, so I put my name down for it and went to Sydney Uni, and that's kind of where I got into it. But I had been doing a bit of community radio, so I really did love radio. I just thought that communications degree would give me a few options in those areas, and yeah, so I went for it.
Where did you do the community radio?
2RRR, actually, down at Ryde on or Gladesville, I guess it is, on Victoria Road, and they taught us how to panel, and I think Mum was my only caller, and she requested Credence, I think, Clearwater Revival. I was like, I don't even know what that is, but sure. And, you know, we used carts and learnt how to, you know, cut tape and do all those old things. And Abe, who's actually one of our technicians at 2UE now, he taught me how to panel back then. And, yeah, it was part of a university show, and it was just good fun to get involved and play tunes, rocking tunes.
Would have been a few interesting characters there at that time as well, I would have thought.
Yeah, it was great. And that was the funny thing, you know, you'd be helping or hosting on a show with someone a few decades older than you, or, you know, other students and people that had been in community radio for years. And, yeah, it was a great chance just to be around a radio station and, yeah, see how it worked.
Tell me about the Sydney Uni course. What was that like for someone that had their eyes pretty much firmly set on a career in radio?
Well, to be honest, there wasn't much radio involved, and it was a general media degree, 4-year degree where you do majors in other things. So I did a major in sociology, and you know, first day when I signed up for uni, I had no idea how it worked. I just went in and they said you have to choose your subjects. So I was like, oh, psychology sounds cool, and philosophy sounds good, and sociology. That's I don't even know what that is. So I signed up for that. Which sounds really naive now, but I just, you know, uni wasn't, we didn't have a lot of people in my family that had been through uni recently, and we didn't have great career advice, I guess, at school, looking back on it now as to going into it. So, yeah, I chose a wide range of subjects, which I think was a really good thing about the Sydney Uni degree. But there wasn't a lot of practical experience. So radio was just one component, one subject over 4 years, really. But I really loved it because we got to do a little bit of everything. There was a lot of media relations. There was a lot of print writing. There was TV. There were, you know, documentary making. It was a little bit of everything. And then it also had the other side of being able to do economics or sociology or whatever else you chose to do. So, yeah, it was a good time. And it was a good course, I think, yeah.
It's funny that a whole lot of people that you speak to, when you talk to them, if they go to university, they seem to go to CSU, whereas Sydney Uni doesn't really rank up there. Was there many people within your course that went on to greater things in media?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Gemma Jones, who's now, I think, editor at the telly, she was she and I used to do all our assignments together because we were both pretty much working full time at the same time as uni. So she was a cadet at the telly doing overnights and then coming to uni during the day. It certainly doesn't have the reputation of Bathurst when it comes to journalism, and a lot of people have gone off into government, PR, those kind of media relations roles. But I think it came down to where you did your internship, and we had a 6-month internship program, and it came down to going out and getting your own experience in media if you wanted to be a journo. It wasn't like we had a radio station at the school, for example, like Bathurst or even UTS has 2 SER at the moment. So you did have to go and get a bit more experience. You know, I joke about Sydney Uni students being great at writing an essay about what's wrong in the media and not necessarily being able to get in and fix it themselves. But, you know, that has changed a lot. I did it. I was like the second year to go through, showing my age. So it's changed a lot since then. And I think no matter which degree you do, you have to go out there and get your own practical experience.
Now, where did you do your work experience or your internship?
I actually did it in the States. By that stage, I was doing a lot of skiing. So I was living in Jindabyne in the winter and driving up to uni 3 or 4 days a week and staying up in Sydney and then driving back down to work in ski resort for the weekend, and then going overseas for my uni break. So from November through March, I'd work in the States. And while I was over there, I worked for a PR ad agency that had a few big clients like Utah Travel, or the big tourism body over there, and Deer Valley, which was the resort I was working at. So I actually didn't do it in media as such. I was working in the States and actually was, by that stage, had kind of gone off the radio idea and thought that it wouldn't be possible and being a journalist would be too hard and I'd never be good enough to do that. So I went on the PR side of things and was really enjoying that route. And so I did mine over there.
And what sort of led you back to pursuing that career in radio? Like you said, you seem to be hell-bent on, you know, enjoying the life as the ski bunny and doing all those kind of things, which,
yeah,
you know, there was the opportunities there down at the ski fields with media units and so forth and doing all that kind of thing, which maybe would have opened the door for you.
Well,
perhaps
that's actually how it happened. So I did a little bit of work experience for the media department at Parish Blue, as it was called then, and we'd get up at 4 in the morning and go up there and just help them out holding the flecky and, you know, I don't know, trudging through the snow and doing hair and makeup and things like that. And that was a really great time to learn from those guys down there about reporting. Like, it was something that's slightly PR style reporting, but it's still the reporting skills. And it was after doing a full-time season at Perisher, I called TUE and I'd been doing their snow reports and said, oh, do you mind giving me a go on the phones or whatever you do? Can I come in? And so that's how I ended up at 2UE in Sydney. But I also did a little bit down at Snow FM, and I remember walking into the studio and thinking, I've got a degree in communications and I don't know what any of these buttons do. And so pretty much that day I applied to go to AFTERS and to do radio as a postgrad 1-year full-time course, because I just thought, right, I've been skiing for 6 years, I did a lot of seasons back to back, and had studied communications and had kind of put the radio thing to the side, and then decided, you know what, I'm going to give it a go. And so it was via Perisher that I got to 2UE.
It's amazing how many people go through university courses or college courses or whatever and then get to the end of it and realise they've put a whole lot of time and effort into learning about these things, but the practical experience doesn't marry up in any way, shape or form, which I don't know whether it reflects badly on the university courses or it's the fact that it's nice to get a nice background in all of that kind of thing. But in reality, unless you live it, you'd never understand it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think if I hadn't gone to AFTERS for the year, I could never have walked in to get a job in a radio station, I don't think. I mean, a lot of people did. I don't want to diss the Sydney Uni course too much, but you're right, it wasn't practical. Like, I think the radio component of reading news was sitting at a desk in a classroom with a microphone in front of you that wasn't plugged into anything, no headphones, and that was learning to read the news. And we had great lecturers and you know, a lot of practice and a lot of theory, but in the end, not actually doing it. But that's what the work placement component of the course was for. And, you know, a lot of people just went out and got their own jobs and did work in the holidays. And I think they're the ones that have gone through and landed in media.
Let's go back again to that media unit down there at Perisher and places like that. I mean, like you said, it gave you a great snapshot of what it could have been like. And those departments back in the day were actually quite big. They're not as big now because I guess the interest level in the companies providing, you know, snow reports and different packages for like Sports Tonight and different things like that, they don't seem to exist as much as they do now. But those guys really had a great understanding of, okay, we need to do X amount of packages per day. We need to deliver them for all of these radio stations. To sort of see that in operation must have been a real eye-opener for you.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, they do 6 TV reports, you know, swapping jackets, swapping beanies, swapping mic flags, and then, you know, going from Fox Sports to Fuel TV to, oh, hang on, it's live for today's show, and then, oh, heck, we forgot about Sky News. And you know, it was amazing how many that could be done in the morning. And the same with radio. We'd be doing, you know, sometimes 20 or 30 radio reports in a morning to all around the country, all around the state, especially in New South Wales. But I think that gave me an understanding of where all the radio stations were, to be honest. That was a really good grounding there. But it was, yeah, it was amazing how they could fit it all in. And that actually probably gave me an insight into what radio is like now, in that, you know, you're not working on one story. You're doing quite a few different things at once.
To you, Ian, afters, tell me about those experiences. First of all, afters, what was that like? You said you wanted to get a more sort of direct and better understanding of radio specifically. What was that course like?
It was fantastic. I remember being in shock when I got in and thinking, oh no, what have I done? I'm going back to school for another year. And then from day one, it was just go, 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 hands on, full time, you know, sometimes 12 hours a day, most weekends as well. And you were doing everything from hosting music shows, not playing credits this time around, to, you know, working out advertising budgets and promotions and doing interviews. And it was one of those courses that covered every angle of a radio station, which was really good. And that's, you know, that comes in handy, just having that knowledge of what the salespeople are doing down the other end of the building and things like that. But that's where I realised I really want to do news. And that's where I met Glenn Daniel and Corinne McKay, actually, who I ended up working for at WS. And I just loved it. We had Jason Morrison and all sorts of amazing, Paul Murray was there, another lecturer. We just had contact with some really great former after students, some of them, but otherwise just people who are working in the industry. And it just made me realize, yep, I definitely want to do news. There's no doubt that's the area of radio that I want to be in.
Was that when it was a more selective course? Because back in the day, and I'm going back a long time now, like 20 odd years, it used to be a selection of about 8 or 10 people that used to get in the course for the year, and that was it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you had to go, you had to submit a tape and write all these essays and whatever else, and then have a few interviews. And then, yep, it was just, I think there were maybe 12 of us from memory. And there was a side course that was more part-time, and it was at the time looking at ABC, SBS style broadcasting as opposed to commercial radio, which had a bit more of a focus on the music FM. And there were a couple of us that were interested in talk and news. But yeah, you're in it for the year, and it was full on. It was out at Macquarie Uni at the time, and it has since moved to Fox Studios at Moore Park, and it's a great facility. But yeah, it's intensive, similar to, I guess, McLay if it were to be just focused on radio.
You mentioned there the 2 year experience when you went in there and you thought, oh God, I need to do something there. What was it about that place there that you thought, okay, I really need to get a better understanding of what's going on?
Well, I think it was more Snow FM walking into a radio station, you know, a commercial brand new radio station at Jindabyne, thinking, gosh, this is a bit different to 2RRR. And then at 2UE, you know, seeing I was producing and as a casual at this stage, I was still, I think, finishing my final year at uni, and I was just doing any shift I could get and answering the phones, and then moved on into producing. And I think it was just watching the newsroom on the other side of the glass and just thinking that's where I want to be. And yeah, I need to work out how to use all this equipment and how to do this a little bit better. And I guess having been through years of uni, I thought further study was probably the best way to do it, you know, rather than working my way through, which I did at the same time. But at the time, it just seemed like the right thing to do was to go back and learn how to do it.
So you met Glenn and Corinne, and they sort of opened the door for you to get to WS. How did that all eventuate? Obviously, you finished your work there.
I was working at 2UE over after the ski season and over the summer doing, you know, producing on breakfast and producing for Clive Robertson, which was great fun, and some fill-in shifts around the place. And then when I got into afters, I left 2UE because it was a full-time course. And then I met Glenn and Corinne during the course at afters, and then towards the end of the course, Corinne called and offered me a position at WS. And I originally told her that I had to think about it, which makes me laugh now, but I just thought I had to go regional. You know, I just thought, no, I can't take a job in Sydney. I've got to go back to Cooma, or I've got to go somewhere else now, because afters and the degree at Sydney Uni, they really drummed it into us that you're not going to get a job in Sydney radio. It's just not the way it works. And, since then, Corinne and I are very close friends, and she laughs all the time thinking, you know, I wanted to slap you when you said you were going to think about it.
Well, take me through that conversation.
Well, I was sitting in the car park at afters, and I remember getting the phone call, and like my heart was racing because I'd, you know, done a little bit of work experience for them and never thought that would happen. But I was really, I think I was just scared of not being good enough at the job, like of actually saying yes to it and then completely falling apart. So I thought, no, I'll go somewhere a bit smaller and, you know, try regional. But of course, you know, after I thought about it for 24 hours, I slapped myself and said yes.
That's where our paths first crossed, when you were working weekends with Cassandra Wood doing Sydney Brisbane out of the WSFM newsroom. I remember having a conversation with Leanne Lincoln, who was working there also at the time. And I said to her, I said, gee, these girls on the weekend are good. And she said, yeah, they'll be good. And I said, oh, Cass seems to be like really confident. And she said, yeah, she is, and she'll be good, but Nat will be the one that will be really good as well. And I went, yeah, I believe you. And then it was just like, I think for you, it was more so about, like you said before, the self-belief kind of thing, backing yourself and wanting to make it work. Whereas like you and Cass were both really hard workers and you knew what to chase, and it was a really good part of your development phase to have Corinne and Glenn like right by your side to give you the feedback that you needed.
It was amazing working there and, you know, with you and with Cass, and we had such a good team with Renee. It was just a really amazing team, and I learned so much from Leanne on the road. I remember, I still think about my very first job. It was with Leanne and I was shadowing her, and we drove through the Cross City Tunnel, and she asked me what the speed limit was. I was like, oh God, I've got no idea. And then I thought, oh my God, what if I'm in trouble for Leanne Lincoln speeding? I was really nervous about it. But we went to Concord Hospital, and I just remember watching her file, and you know, I had no idea. I couldn't remember what I was meant to be filing first, and I learned so much from her and from Cass and, of course, Glenn and Corinne. It was a really great time. I remember actually it wasn't just a lack of confidence. I was pretty crap. Like, I remember the first bulletin and I was so out of breath. I was so nervous that I couldn't get through anything, and poor Renee Smith was standing there. We had to record it wasn't even live. It was recorded. We had to get it in by a certain amount of time. And I'd turn around and go, can we just take the one I did before? Because this one's not working either. And she was looking at me thinking, no, you've got to read the whole bulletin. You know,
I
was just so nervous. And I remember, I needed a lot of hand holding early on, but that was the place to get that. You know, we had so much feedback and we had so much, knowledge around us to soak up.
Was it a case of just doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it again that allowed you to get over those nerves and feel more confident in your delivery?
Oh, it felt good after I'd done one, like once I got one through. Yeah, definitely. I think And it was also getting air checked, you know. Glenn Daniel would sit down with us and go through the bully and listen back and, you know, I don't know, he's just the best air checker you could ever have, really, and he spent a lot of time with us. But, yeah, it's just practice, but also learning what to do. Like, you know, I hadn't been in a newsroom. That was my first newsroom job. So once we were shown, yeah, you just practice and practice. And Cass was a huge support for me. She was so great at writing sport, and we had a really good little team going on weekends there, and I think I learned a lot from Cass as well.
Like you say, I mean, I tell anyone that works in radio that they haven't really experienced a radio newsroom unless they've worked with Glenn Daniel, because without doubt, the best in terms of, as you said, air checking other staff, but also just the fact that he'd back his staff. He's also just so professional in every aspect of getting the news together. So that means him turning up at work at ridiculous hours, like hours before anyone would contemplate getting out of bed, going through every paper with a fine-tooth comb. Just, I think I would say that to anyone, and I still say that to anyone, to just work a day with Glenn Daniel and you'll learn more than any courses that you could ever have written in the history of radio.
100%. And I feel really lucky to have worked under him for quite a few years there. I mean, it starts with his immaculate desk. Like he's got these piles of releases, you know, they're in an order, everything has its place. And it goes from there. You know, he's organized and structured in what he does. His hours are planned out. His bulletins are planned out. And I think that was really important to learn early on. And, you know, Corinne, as his deputy, was backing that up. And, well, she was Sydney News Director rather than Group News Director. But they were amazing to work for. And I'm still really close with both of them. And I feel really lucky to have worked for Glenn. It's a brilliant news director.
So do you think working in that newsroom where you had to be across not only Sydney issues but Brisbane issues because we're all sort of based there, do you think that helped you become a little bit more sort of well-rounded just in that? Because there's a lot of national stories, but then it sort of forced you to be in touch with what's happening in another state.
Yeah, well, I read Brekkie for 97.3 for quite a while, and then at 9 a.m. I'd switch over and do mornings for WS and Mix. So you had to, all of us had to be across both cities both days. I think what it really taught me is that you don't actually, scary as it sounds, you don't need to be in a city to do the news for it anymore. Like, this is the way it's, scarily, this is kind of where it's going, is I can sit at North Ryde and be in touch with police media up there and all the different services. I can be rolling on State Parliament on the computer watching it. I've, you know, had a couple of webcams so that I knew what the weather was doing in the city and Bayside, and I could be in Brisbane essentially, whether I was sitting in an office in North Sydney or up in Queensland. I'd like to think we were providing the same news service at breakfast. And yeah, that did, I guess set a framework or, you know, just teach you how to work across different cities, which you have to do. It's just the way it is now, yeah.
And when did you feel as though you were comfortable? You thought, because like you said, it takes some people longer than others, and then one day you go through a day and you just think, yep, I've done that, and there's been no hesitation, there's been no cock-ups, there's been – I feel comfortable and I feel I'm a newsreader now.
Gosh, that's a really tricky question. I don't know if I've ever really felt – really comfortable with it.
Really?
The cock-ups are still happening.
I said
Malcolm Shorten yesterday morning. So that is still happening. I think I've always, I remember the first day I read WS at 10 a.m. and felt really nervous. And then, yeah, you get used to it. The nerves die down. I was so nervous about moving to 2GB when I went from WS to here. And then, you know, each new role, I get nervous about it and, you know, just worried about.
Why is that,
doing,
do you think?
I don't know. I guess I care. And not nervous to the point where I can't breathe and I'm shaking, although I've had that before. But I think I just care and I just want to do a good job, I guess. I am comfortable reading the news. You know, I'm not thinking about actually reading the news while I'm reading. I'm thinking about the story. And that's something Glenn always taught us, that when you get in there, take a big breath, and no matter what's been going on out there, no matter how mad it's been for the past 25 minutes getting the bulletin together, take a breath and you've got to be in that moment. And so I think that while I'm, you know, still feel a bit nervous about doing it, while I'm actually doing it, I'm not thinking about the nerves, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's more on the way in, and the idea of, you know, taking a new job or accepting a new role, that it comes with the nerves, but actually doing it at the top of the hour, you're in the moment. As zen as that sounds.
Yeah, yeah. I guess people would think that if they're listening to the radio station, and I've got mates that still ask me, so what do you do between the bulletins? And, like, that's my most hated question of all time, because essentially AWS was different to 2GB. 2GB, you've got more resources and things like that, like in terms of people on the road that can file for you. Mm. AWS, for the most part, it's just you a lot of the time, or you and one other. And if you've got three stories that break at once, the time that you have to present it never changes. You can't ask for more time to complete an assignment. Like, the hourly deadline is the hourly deadline, regardless of what's happening in the outside world. So was that hard to adjust to initially, just trying to get all of those pieces to the puzzle and put them all together and present them in a fashion that people would listen to on the radio?
Yeah, editing is one of the tricky things. And as you said, there's the clock's ticking. It's not like you've got time, like, for example, at uni or when you're practicing to craft it and, you know, spend hours thinking about it. You're on a deadline. Again, the organisation that Glenn and Corinne used in their own editing, I think, really helped all of us at WS. But, you know, we worked bulletins ahead there because you really were short-staffed, and if one story came up, you'd be screwed. So you had to have a lot in the can for the next half hour and the hour after that. Yeah, I think nowadays, I mean, it still happens at 2GB. I just had to run out now when, you know, there's the Greyhound racing industry has just been scrapped. We've got credit ratings, Standard & Poor's going nuts. You know, everything was just happening, and there's one person sitting in there. You know, that still happens at 2GB, 2UE right now. And so that's something that I think, yes, it happened in FM, but it still happens in AM, and it's just something you have to cope with, I guess. Makes you fast.
You talked about going out on the road there with Leanne Lincoln in the early days at WS. Was on-the-road reporting something that also interests you? Or because people go one of two ways. They love reading the news, or they love being out on the road. Some people are able to do both really well, but generally speaking, people prefer one over the other. Getting that taste at WS, albeit on a smaller scale to what you do at 2GB now, what sort of pushed you in the direction that you wanted to go?
To be honest, I'm still straddling both. I still love both sides of it. And at WS, I had this awesome gig where I read Breakfast. I think I was on Mix at the time, and then went out on the road for the second half of the shift. And that was my dream scenario. And then when I was offered a position at 2GB, it was similar. It was reading afternoons for Chris Smith, but on the road beforehand or after, depending on where the shift started and finished. And I've been lucky to kind of continue that through. For a while there, I was reading Breakfast and mornings for a couple of years, but now I'm back on reading mornings, and then I'm on the road from 9 till 1 or 2 in the afternoon, whenever it finishes. And I really like being able to do both. So I'm still torn between both of them. And
what's the appeal for on the road reporting? What do you love about that?
Oh, you're telling stories, you know, you're finding out what's going on and you're calling it in. And the best thing about radio is it's happening right now and it's immediate, and you can just call up on your phone and file. And yeah, I just love the adrenaline of it and going out there and actually getting the story, the journalism aspect, rather than collating news and putting it together and reading it. So I still love both.
Using words to describe a situation is something that the tools of the trade for any radio journalist, and that is a real skill and a real art. Who would you say taught you how to present that in such a way when you're out at the scene as an on-road reporter?
Well, definitely Leanne had influence there, because I was on the road with her in those early days. Corinne McKay as well, because she was the one I was filing to. And I remember my very first crime scene was at North Ryde, at some kind of village where priests were living, and someone had been stabbed. And there was blood everywhere, and there was a trail of blood, and you could see these two hands on the white wall. And I described it to her in the Vox, and she was drumming in, you know, have you checked your facts? And she's like, is it blood? I'm like, well, yeah, it's blood. So have you checked? So I had to walk over to the cops and ask, just want to confirm that's blood. They looked at me like I was an idiot. Of course it's blood. It's not ketchup. But, you know, the point was Corinne was just drumming in, you know, you need to learn your facts. And I think when I'd filed at her and she'd be like, well, hang on, you could have been sitting here. What can you see? What can you smell? What are you hearing? And it was those questions from her, I think, that made me think of the senses when I'm reporting. So run through that list and then try and work some of it into the report if you can.
So how was it that you ended up at 2GB? You said there that you had a number of years at WS and, you know, being in that building and working for Mix and, you know, doing all that kind of stuff, reporting into the Queensland stations and all of that. Did it come at a stage where you needed a change or were looking for a greater challenge? How was it that you ended up at 2GB?
No, I was still enjoying that mix and, you know, getting to cover some big things because, you know, was it World Youth Day and, gosh.
Like would have been a couple of elections there.
A few elections. There was a Queensland election, Kevin 07's election, where I got to go on the road a bit, which was great, up in Queensland and here. There were some natural disasters and then I just got a call from Erin Maher at 2GB asking to catch up for coffee. And I was really didn't want to leave Glenn and Corinne and this amazing team that we had over at WS. But, you know, the time was right and it was a great opportunity to jump over to AM. And so I did.
What was the conversation like with Glenn? I'm sure, I have no doubt he would have been just so supportive.
He was. That was the thing. I think, you know, I would have been in tears beforehand. I would have been, I remember telling Jim Dolan too. And that, you know, Jim was so wonderful to work with. And I remember being really nervous to tell him as well. But yeah, Glenn was so supportive. And I remember him saying, you know, there's not even any point really arguing over pay rises or anything because this is what you want. And, It was just the right time to go, and he's been supportive ever since.
So that on-road reporting, you mentioned there are a couple of stories that you went to. When you went to TGB, if I'm not mistaken, you went and covered Christchurch, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was probably 4 months after I'd started at 2GB, and it was just an accident really because the reporter who would have gone at the time didn't have a passport or it was out of date or something.
Wow. And who was that?
Can't remember exactly. And it filed through, and then Jess Campanaro was deputy news director at the time, so she was kind of the next in line, and she was actually pregnant at the time, not that we all knew, but that was her decision to not go then. And then it filed down to me, and I was due to read the 11 a.m. news bulletin, and Erin said, "Do you want to go to the airport?" So someone took over at about 10 to 11, and I swung past home and packed a little backpack and some gumboots and went to the airport. And didn't go anywhere for 24 hours because, of course, all the flights were cancelled. But eventually got to Wellington and then hitchhiked to the boat and got the boat across to the South Island and then hitchhiked with a guy, a man who whose grandmother lived in Christchurch. So he wanted to get down to check on her because the phones were all down. So I hitchhiked with him. We went via his house and met his wife and his kids who were very confused as to what was going on. And she gave me bottles of water and muesli bars, and then we arrived at Christchurch at 7 in the morning and it was go, go, go from there.
So you had a great story on the way to the story, which, you know, journalists are painted in a really poor light at times, but there's so many great people that work in the industry that have that ability to tell stories and to communicate what's going on, and the lengths that they go to get those stories are often better than the stories themselves sometimes.
Yeah, it was a bit of an ordeal, but at the time, you know, that's just what you're doing to get there. That's part of the fight, and you know everyone else is trying to get there too, and TV stations were chartering planes, and, you know, especially in radio, you're usually on your own, so it's a bit easier to move around and you can, you know, chat to people on a boat and work out who's going somewhere. And, yeah, it worked. It was tricky to find accommodation once I got there because it was a war zone. It really was. You know, there were tanks everywhere, military. It just had that feeling about it, and it was still shaking. So it was, a tough assignment. But, you know, the tough part was seeing these people who'd lost their homes. I stood with one family while their home was pulled down, and I've since caught up with them, and they've split their family up. The couple's divorced. They've left Christchurch. You know, they're those stories. And there was one lady at a supermarket who I was trying to interview, but then, you know, once she went to say something, she just started bawling, and we just stood there hugging in a supermarket for like half an hour, like weirdos. But it was just that she was just so upset. I went to a wedding while I was over there of a guy that rescued his fiance from the rubble in the CCTV, I think it was, in one of the, I can't even remember now which building it was.
Yeah.
And quite a few of us journos went there to report on it and ended up hanging around with the crowd after. And, you know, it was a really emotional time, but it was a pretty incredible experience as a reporter as well, which feels weird to say, you know, like it was such a horrible, horrible natural disaster. And we saw bodies and we saw families that were searching for bodies, and yet we're having to drive through in a bus, point our cameras at it and stick our microphones in there every day. It's, it's tricky to get your head around, but it's part of the job.
Something that Sarah Harris spoke about earlier on in this podcast series, like almost like reporter's guilt. You got to do a job, but there's some heavy stuff going on while you're there, and you get called all kinds of different names. But essentially, like I said, you're just there to do a job.
Yeah.
Can be really difficult at times.
It can, and it's not even just natural disasters. That's just court, you know, sticking your microphone in someone's face as they run out of the Downing Centre. You know, that can be, you can cop just as much flack doing it there. And yeah, you feel kind of scummy sometimes, to be honest. But as you said, it's the job. And if the story needs to be told, then there's a reason for you being there.
How do you balance your emotion in a situation like that, which, like you said, you've seen so much devastation, but you've also got to put your straight face on and do live crosses and do reports for the news and all of those kind of things. How do you manage that?
I think most journos are probably the same. While you're in it, the emotion's kind of put to the side. Like, you can have empathy, but you're working. You're thinking of facts. You're trying to convey the story, and you know you're working to a deadline, so you're busy. I don't think it's till after that you often pause and realize. Or maybe you don't, you just move on. And, you know, as you've said before, us journos like to drink. So maybe that's the coping mechanism rather than dealing with the emotion at the time. But I think you just put it aside, you do your job, and then, you know, sometimes it comes back after and you feel it a little bit. But otherwise it's just business as usual, I guess.
Another thing that is business as usual, dealing with emotional conflict on more so on an internal level, when we sort of reflect back on the merger between 2UE and 2GB, well, probably 18 months ago now. What was that time like working in that environment when speculation was swirling around as to what may or may not happen? Now, I lived through it in 2003 when the similar sort of thing happened, but it didn't go through. What was it like when it actually came to pass?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, that talk about 2UE and 2GB merging has been around since before I was in radio. You know, it's been around forever. So I don't think I thought it was actually going to happen, to be honest. It was tough. You know, it was tough for everyone at 2GB and 2UE, just not knowing. I think that was one of the hardest things. Once the decision was made and, you know, we'd merged, it was horrible. We lost really awesome people from 2UE and 2GB. We've had to merge. It's just a commercial reality, you know. It happened to newspapers, it happened to TV rooms, and then suddenly it was happening to us. So, yeah, it was a horrible time. It really was.
Is it a shame? Do you think that competitiveness doesn't exist anymore? Because while people kind of look at it that, oh, you know, they're racing for the stories and doing all that kind of thing, I kind of look back on it now and I just think, that is just so much of a us versus them mentality, which is built up over so many years, that when I look back now, I just think it's so much energy wasted needlessly on this, when a lot of the times you're friends with the other reporter, you're still trying to get on air first and you're trying to stick that microphone up there in front of the other guy that's working for the other joint. But I just think, Joe Public out there in listener land, he couldn't give a rat's.
No, they're only listening to the one station. They're not flicking between the news to see who got it up first, or you know, who had the better angle. I think that's still there. Sure, we've lost the dual newsrooms in the commercial sphere in Sydney. And so now, you know, we're 2GB 2UE newsroom, and I love that we still see Packy sticking up the 2UE mic. You know, you still see the 2UE mic up, and I do the 2UE outro in the news as well as the 2GB outro. It's great to have, you know, still a really strong newsroom. But we're still competing with the ABC, but we're still competing with now more, you know, you've got every man and their dog on Twitter. You've got online services streaming constantly. You know, your TVs have, what, 6 news bulletins a day now. Sky News is streaming live. So you're still trying to get it up first. Nowadays, you don't wait till the top of the hour. You know, you've got to be on live because everyone else is doing that. So I don't think the competition's gone. Maybe it's just spread out a little bit. It's not that 2UE versus 2GB at a press conference anymore, but it's still, you know, the reporter for Macquarie Media battling with everyone else to get it out there first.
When the merger did happen and it was all out of the one joint, did you find that things just settled into stride pretty much straight away? How was it dealt with from an internal perspective?
Yeah, it was April last year that we merged, and we merged into the Pyrmont building. And, you know, For those of us who survived the cut at 2GB, we wanted to make a real effort to make sure that those coming from the other side of the bridge felt welcome and that we were a merged newsroom. And I think the newsroom did it really well. Like, I think from day one, we've just been working really well together. And I think everyone knows that we're all nice people, and it doesn't matter which side you came from, it wasn't our decision for it to happen. And so, yeah, it's been working really smoothly, I think. And there were all sorts of things said about how horrible it would be, but then it just worked, you know, and we were on air. I was on air reading 2UE Breakfast on the following Monday. Like, it just happened overnight.
Take me through a day in the life of you. How does it work from the moment you get up? What time would you get up in the morning, and what do you do to prepare for a day when you're reading on the Alan Jones Breakfast Show and then going out on the road, which you now do?
Well, I'm up at 3:30, 3:40 if I don't need to
hit the snooze.
Don't need to rush. Into the studio by about 4:30, and I'm reading wires, reading the papers, getting my head around what's happening, putting together briefs for breakfast news. And I'm on air at about 5:15 doing updates, doing a cross with the pre-breakfast program, and then I'm reading the news from 5:30. And then it's half-hourly bulletins through to 9 o'clock. And in between, like you said before, you're not lying around doing nothing. You're taking calls and putting in calls, and rolling on programs interviews is one of the main things I do too. So when Alan's got the Prime Minister on, that's I'm rolling and turning that around for the next bulletin. And then come 9 o'clock, I'm out on the road, usually, sometimes. Depends day to day what the jobs list is looking like. So today I was at the Archibald announcement, which was great. Could be court, could be sport, whatever the day brings. Or I'm in reading the national pre-feed bulletins. So we do a national bulletin every hour. So that requires a whole person in there. So some days I'll do that. Some days I'll be on the road. And then clock off sometime after 12:30.
Now talk to me about reading the news for Alan Jones. You mentioned you hadn't always sort of felt comfortable. Was that something that you wanted to do, or is that something that somebody said to you, Nat, we'd like you to read for Alan? Being the Sydney Radio Breakfast institution that he is, it must have been just like, wow.
Well, yeah, I remember just even reading for Chris Smith in the afternoons, you know, was huge. Just to read the news on 2GB when I'd been listening to it for a long time was a lot to get my head around. And then I was filling in for Joel Larby on breakfast while he was away, so I guess that's how I eased into it. But, yeah, there's that pressure there when it's, you know, the Alan Jones Breakfast Show. It's just knowing how many people are listening and you know, you've got to get it right. And same when you're reading for Ray Hadley or anyone really on the station. You've got that the pressure of knowing everyone's listening. And after the Sochi Olympics, I came back and went full-time into the breakfast role, so it's been two and a bit years in breakfast.
Any blow-ups?
Oh, you know, I'm trying to think of a particularly bad.
Everyone's got good stories about blow-ups.
Yeah, Alan. He did get caught saying, I think, who's this woman reading my news once or something like that, but that's not a blow-up.
Standard.
That's Alan. No, you know what? It's one of those things where you've just got to put your head down and work and get it right. You know, there's that old saying, don't F it up. And that's, you know, what we all say to each other in the newsroom is a bit of a joke, but we mean it. Like, just put your head down, work, get it right, and then you'll be fine.
You're pretty fortunate to go to London for the Olympics there as well.
Gosh, yeah.
Talk to me about that experience. What was that like?
That was amazing because we were rights holders. So we had, you know, the whole commentary team over there, you know, Gordon Bray and Ray Hadley and all these amazing names that you've heard commentating different sports. It was a rush. It was flat out. So Joel Larby and I had, we didn't have accreditation, so we were on the outside of all the venues doing the grassy knolls, which are the press conferences after the events, and covering everything else, you know, like there was a taxi driver that jumped off a bridge and, you know, all of those sort of other stories that are going on around it, court stories and athletes behaving badly. So we were covering all of that.
I believe they call that colour.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of, I mean, the best thing about the Olympics is you don't need accreditation. So, you know, you're not Channel 7, but you can be standing covering the road race or the marathon or, you know, in the middle of town. So we got to do a lot of sport coverage as well. So it was a buzz. It was amazing. We didn't sleep much. You know, met some incredible people, interviewed some amazing athletes, and yeah, kind of gave me that Olympic bug.
Over the summer, you were given the opportunity to work with Michael Packey to present your own show on a Sunday night.
Yeah,
just you two, filling in for Miranda Devine, and it turns out that she never came back, so you're still there.
Yeah, who would have thought? We were both really shocked to get the call up, and it was actually Paul Bowd in management who thought of putting us together and then just called and said, you guys want to give it a go? And you can't say no, can you? It was an amazing opportunity. So we thought we'd definitely give it a go, and it was meant to be 5 weeks, and we'd planned out our 5 weeks, and, you know, we're ready for a break after that. And then, yeah, it's rolled on, which is great. Miranda took some time off to be an HSC mum this year. She's got a kid in year 12, and, you know, she's so full on with her TV and print commitments, so we're still here.
Is that something that you've wanted to do, or had an idea that perhaps you may have wanted to move into that presenting area? Because, you know, and it's very old school way of thinking, but having women on radio, particularly talkback, isn't or hasn't been embraced as perhaps as well as it should have. You get that opportunity there to use your skills that you've learnt for X number of years as a journalist and a newsreader, which you know a lot of the issues and the topics. It's just presenting it in a different way. How have you found that experience?
It's actually been surprisingly different to my work in the newsroom. So I found it, very difficult to put my opinion out there. And that's probably the biggest challenge is putting aside that impartiality that we've trained ourselves to use, you know, to recognize your bias and counter it, putting that aside and going, this is what I think. Love me or hate me, this is what I think about all these issues that I've, you know, hid my opinion for all those years on. And I've been getting some great advice from John Brennan, and he's the one that says, put your opinion out there. And, you know, that's why Ray and Alan are all so successful. And that has been really hard to do that. And I'm still learning, like, still struggling to even give one opinion during a show. I find that unnatural. So I've got so much to learn. It's not something that I thought I would ever do. It's not something I'd been chasing. But the opportunity fell in front of us, and, yeah, we're still going.
And looking at that, interviewing in a long form format as opposed to talking to somebody and getting the money grab for the news,
the 10-second grab.
Yeah. To have those questions or to follow up and really listen to what the person's saying as opposed to narrowing in on the focus or the story of the day to sort of get those people to expand upon the stories, whatever it may be. Have you found that part of it challenging also?
Yes, because there's so much going on, you know, behind the scenes. I mean, I'm not even paneling. We've got a panel op. You know, we're in, it's a luxury, but yeah, it's hard to just slow down and listen when you're worried about what's next, which, you know, whether you've got callers, is the next interview up, all of that stuff's happening. It's also just, there's so much research involved when you are doing those longer format interviews, whereas when you're in the newsroom, quite often someone calls in and like, gosh, what's this about? Okay, yep, what's your thought on the matter? You know, that magic first question where you really don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, yeah, yep, that's on the front page of the telly. Whoops. But it's so different to that, of course. So it's just hours of prep, and producers are so important, you know, that's they're your backup. So, yeah, it's very different.
And what's it like working with Michael Packey, who is, and I've said this a few times on this podcast, without doubt, the hardest working man I've met in media.
He hasn't taken a Sunday off since we started in November.
Of course he hasn't.
I've had two off. And, I'm worried for him. He needs a holiday. But, no, he's amazing. You know, he's got such an incredible political brain, and he can chat about it. You know, he can make it interesting. And it's been great. We had only ever worked opposing each other in election campaigns before this, you know, and then we're, of course, in the same newsroom now. And, I think we're forging a really good friendship, as well as eventually, you know, hopefully becoming a good on-air team. And I give him a hard time about being a bit of a political dork, and he gives me a hard time about sport and whatever else. And, yeah, it's good.
It's not uncommon in radio to have these arranged marriages, but it seems to work for you guys.
Yeah, we get on really well, you know, and we're really interested in what we're doing. You know, we're both really into news and really into what's going on in the world, so we'll have chats about things. You know, I talk to him more than I talk to my parents. Like, you know, we'll spend an hour on the phone, you know, talking about what we're going to talk about on the show, and you know, and planning. And we're quite similar in our thinking, which means we don't have a lot to fight about on air. You know, we've got to start looking for things to really have a debate on, but we're quite similar in our thinking.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been great getting to know Packy better, although I have to stop calling him Packy. I've been told it has to be Michael on air.
Michael, yeah.
Never called him Michael in my life.
No one's called him Michael.
Yeah, so I have to write it, like, out, Michael, on the top of quite a few sheets so that I remember to call him Michael.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
You're also involved in a number of charitable causes, and you love doing that side of things. What's that? Does it give you a good balance in life?
Yeah, it keeps me busy as well, but it's you know, it's just purely out of interest, I think. And you know, I'd love to be doing more. And that's just a timing thing. With Soldier On, it's just a little bit of helping out their communications team every now and then, like with just like more as a professional volunteer. That's a cause that's really close to my heart, because I've had quite a few ancestors and relatives now that have served in military here and overseas, and including one. Actually, I was in Gallipoli last year for work and found the grave of one of them, which was incredible.
Wow.
But also another one suffered terrible melancholy, which is now considered post-traumatic stress disorder, and was on and off a boat in Gallipoli and ended up dying in Egypt, and, you know, was just traumatized. And reading through his military inquest and to what life was like for him day to day, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, it just makes you really, it makes me sad, but it also makes you realise what we have to be doing for the guys that are serving now. So that's where my interest in that comes from. I do a bit with suicide prevention groups, youth suicide prevention, and trying to do a bit more for the Stroke Foundation, because my father had a stroke 6 years ago, which just changed everything for our family, and he was really lucky to survive, but it's, you know, a lot of the time it's preventable, so it's just getting the message out there. And I don't do much with the Stroke Foundation. It's just more same thing, spreading the word and, you know, wearing my blue string around my wrist and telling everyone about it when I can. And, yeah.
We'll wrap things up in a sec, but before we go, I just want some advice from you for anyone that's looking to break into radio or media these days. It's become a whole lot harder than what it used to be due to the sort of fragmentation. And on the flip side, things like what we're doing now, podcasts, have made things more, I guess, readily available for people to experiment and try to get their skills to a certain level. So what would your advice be to anyone looking to get a start in radio or media?
Firstly, get those skills up, you know, start a podcast, volunteer, do internships. You know, we actually don't get that many people contact us at 2GB wanting internships.
Really?
Yeah, I run the program and we really just don't get that many. Quite often, you know, none from a university in a whole year. So, you know, ask. It's put in the call, find out who to speak to first, do it properly and ask for work experience. It's a great opportunity. If you want to get into radio, look after your vocal cords and, you know, the cigarettes, booze, karaoke, all of those sorts of things do a lot of damage. And I really struggled. I think I was still at WS, and when I moved over to 2GB, I was having big trouble losing my voice. And that was just from not looking after it. You know, not that I was out boozing every night, but, you know, it takes a lot of strain on your vocal cords. So I think that on a practical front, that would be my other advice. Someone else said keep a little black book of every person you ever meet in the industry, because eventually you'll work with them and or want to work with them, and, you know, you need to get in touch. So I guess, yeah, just work keeping track of your contacts is another great one, because as we know, you end up working with people more than once, and, yeah, don't burn any bridges, I guess.
Natalie Peters, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Ralphie.
There she is, Natalie Peters from 2GB. If you really enjoyed my chat today with Natalie, please let her know by sending her a tweet. She's at Natalie J. Peters. You can also follow us on Twitter, which is at MediaMatesAU. Check out the Facebook page. Most importantly, if you could subscribe in iTunes, that'd be great. It means you won't miss an episode. While you're there, leave a rating or review, and that way more people will learn about the show. Until next time, I'm Ralph Tucker, and this has been the Media Mates Podcast. Media Mates Podcast.